Disclaimer time. This is where I tell everyone to lighten up. It's just a podcast. Trading is like that roller coaster at the amusement park. Thrilling, unpredictable, and potentially stomach churning. What works for one person might leave another clutching their hat in the wind. Our hosts and guests, they're awesome, knowledgeable, full of insights, but we're not financial advisors. So don't rush to make any investment decisions based solely on our banter. Always consult with a professional or do your own research. Plus, let's face it, we like to have fun, laugh, enjoy the trading ride together. It's all in the name of good podcasting fun. So remember, take it easy, don't bet the farm, and keep your seatbelts on at all times. Thank you for listening. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the China Shop, home of the Band of Traders podcast. I am your host, Kyle, and today I've got John Cousins on the mic with me. John is an investor, tech founder, educator, and best-selling author of, that can't be right, can it? Over 60 books, is that right?
I just published my 63rd, yeah, so.
What? Oh, my goodness.
I'm a beast. A writing beast.
How long have you been writing books, and why?
Well, there is an old quote by a famous mathematician, Erdős, and he said, "I'm a machine that turns coffee into theorems." I think I'm a machine that turns coffee into books. But Paul Erdős. But I've been doing it for a good decade, probably about 15 years now. And really when I started was basically around, I was teaching. Mm-hmm. In, universities, after I founded a bunch of companies, I started teaching. My sister was teaching finance as she was working evenings in the university. I thought, that's so cool. So I started teaching. And as I was doing that, I started developing more and more of my own materials, and then I started cobbling those together. And then Amazon came out with this incredible platform. A lot of my right. stuff that I've done is platform enabled. As the platform comes along, then I start to, take advantage of it, figure out how I could use it. And, Kindle Direct Publishing, I could put a book up there. It's just even a Word document, and then they have a cover creator, and then boom, you start selling it. So that gave me the impetus to start to write them. And yeah, so.
So it's a lot. The barrier to entry sounds like it's really come down for writing a book then.
Absolutely. The barrier to entry really came down, and you could deliver it, costlessly to all these, different people. The interesting thing is it makes a Kindle ebook, and it also makes, they do this thing called POD, print on demand. So when somebody orders a paperback or a hardcover, they print that one book right away and send that out. So in the past, you have to cover the fixed costs of printing. You'd have to print 1,000 books, and you have them in your garage, and somebody would order one. You'd go out, put it in a mailer, and send it out. I used to do that with CDs too. And now, suddenly, no inventory, no working capital tied up in inventory. So relatively a costless kind of venture, other than the time to write the book. And as they say, if you underthink, read. If you overthink, write. That's what it's been, just dumping stuff out of my mind.
That explains the wide variety of topics then too, because it looks like you've written on things from business courses to finance to the one that really caught my eye was learning to learn. I kind of want to talk about that a little bit.
That's been a key for me, is how especially in this day and age, it's how in this accelerated world, how do we learn and also key, how do we unlearn so that we can relearn, because... We tend to have things, it was always done that way, and now suddenly the world has shifted to a new paradigm, and what used to serve us well no longer does. And that can be a challenge to let go of, our thinking and change it and learn something new. Interesting with learning to learn, I've been thinking about that, the switching costs of learning. And, on a typewriter, there's they call it QWERTY, and QWERTY is the Q... W-E-R-T-Y, the top of the left hand. And that QWERTY keyboard, that configuration of why the keys were in that configuration.
I know why.
What?
It's for the typewriters. Yeah, it's to keep the typewriters from jamming up.
Exactly. They wouldn't jam up. So it actually slowed you down and put the keys in different areas. So after that mechanical constraint went away, people started thinking about, keyboards for computers could be different. And so they came up with this one called Dvorak, named after the old classical composer. And it was a much more efficient keyboard, allowed you to type way faster, but we still have QWERTY keyboards. And why is that? Because of the switching costs. Once you learn how to type, do you really want to spend the time to learn how to retype if it's not, if there's an incremental advantage, but they say for switching costs, you really need like a 10x advantage to make people say, okay, I'm convinced I'm going to put in the time to go up this new learning curve on something. So we get stuck in the past with these legacy, you know, ideas because the switching costs are considered to be too much relative to the benefit.
There's not enough incentive there. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've dealt with that a lot in the past, and I can't tell you how many times I got annoyed at a manager or somebody else trying to tell me that's the way we've always done things here. It's like, yeah, well, that doesn't mean, I mean, safety standards have changed a lot in the last 20 years. That doesn't mean that's still the safe way to do it.
Absolutely. And a lot of times, you know, in learning, guys like Elon Musk and say SpaceX, you know, who would have thought that you could make a commercial space company that could compete with like NASA and, you know, the European Space Agency and all these ones. And it goes back to that, you know, first principles thinking. You have to break things down back into the first principles and test all the assumptions and see whether they still apply or not, and then build up from there. And, you know, that kind of thinking is that's another part of that learning to learn is how do you go back to first principles and figure out, you know, what are the foundational beliefs and assumptions that you're carrying along that may no longer, maybe there's a new technology or some way of doing things differently. Like you say, it's always been done that way. Well, time to do it a different way, right?
Well, everyone else is changing. If you don't change, you're going to get left behind. That's right.
That's right. It's either learn or die. You know, like Darwin said, it's not the smartest or the fastest animal that surprises that survives. It's the most adaptable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, adaptation has to be one of our skill sets, or like you say, we'll just, you know, become irrelevant.
You know, Darwinism is such a fascinating theory because you look at something like a tiger and you think, oh, that's an evolved, like, that's just such a great, what's the right word? It's just a beautiful, like, perfect killing machine. Like, you look at that and you think, oh, right. What could be better? But then you also look at something like a rabbit, and I'd argue the rabbit's a lot more successful. It doesn't live nearly as long. It's not nearly as glamorous, but it breeds really quick. And that's all that matters when you're trying to propagate your species.
That's right. And, you know, the Stephen Wright, the comedian, said, you know, eagles can soar, but weasels don't get caught in jet engines.
Right. My favorite joke he ever said. Stephen Wright's the one who's like real depressed, right? Is that the guy?
Yeah, he's hilarious.
I watched him. He did some bit where he talked about a cop pulling him over and says, you're going 50 in a 30. And he's like, I'm sorry, officer. I didn't know I was going to be out that long. Like, oh, man, that's such a good joke. I've been waiting to get pulled over so I could try to pull that one.
Yeah, there you go.
Let's go back to the learning. You said something there about like tips for unlearning things. Can you talk to me a little bit more about like that idea? Like, what are some of the tools or even how do you identify something that you need to unlearn?
Well, and that's a good, there's a quote by the guy who wrote Future Shock, and I can't think of it, but in the future, it's, you know, which is now, the biggest skill is going to not be how to, you know, learn things, but how to unlearn and then relearn. And one of the big skills, I think, is to always be thinking about what are the underlying beliefs that were and assumptions that we're carrying along that drive our behavior, so that we're always, you know, is this something that actually, you know, I'm doing this and why am I doing this? Well, I'm doing this, you know, fundamentally because of XYZ. And then, okay, is that something that I can test and see, is that still serving me or can I do it different? And it goes back to that first principles kind of thinking too, you know, breaking things down and finding out, you know, why we're doing things. Basically, you know, we're all driven by our beliefs and how do we continually reassess, you know, our beliefs and how they're serving.
It sounds a lot like NLP. That you're saying a lot of the things that I've heard, like Rich Friesen, who's a trader psychologist we've talked to a lot in the past. Like, he uses a lot of that same language, the underlying beliefs for trying to like correct behaviors. So it's interesting that you can apply that to learning.
Neuro-linguistic programming, huh?
Yeah. So did you study any of that?
I've read about it and all, yeah. And so I think I've maybe subconsciously ingrained a lot of it because of... And I think a lot, you know, with things that have a, you know, kernel of truth to them, there's lots of different ways that they get expressed. And then you say, oh, yeah, that's, you know, even with religion or something, you know, there's like all these different religions that say they're the one true religion. But at basis, you know, there's some spiritual beliefs that are, you know, maybe kind of true that get expressed in all these different ways across cultures and things.
Yeah.
So, yeah, NLP, I think, is a good thing. When you talk about NLP and beliefs and investing, One of my favorite books is that the Psychology of Money, the Morgan Housel.
I don't think I've read that one, The Psychology of Money.
Oh, it's super. Just even, Google search it, and there's tons of things like, 10 quotes from Psychology of Money. Morgan Housel was a big trader. I forget which trading company or investment bank he worked for, but might have been Morgan Stanley or J.P. Morgan, because his name is Morgan. Maybe that's not Morgan Housel. I'm thinking of the Morgans, but one of those places. And then he became, why our beliefs about money, how they influence whether or not we can be successful. And that's an idea we hear a lot about too, that we have these underlying beliefs that, money's not good. So then, we shy away from it. And then obviously then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? We don't get wealthy, right. We don't get successful.
You might really enjoy Rich Friesen's book that he just put out, The Private Conversations with Money. It's kind of the same lines of that. It's all about, it's done in like a workshop type format. So you're supposed to be able to play along and do the exercises as you're reading the book and the story. It's actually a pretty good story too.
Wow, I would. I'll look into that.
Yeah, I'll shoot
I'm
you
always looking
me.
for. I mean, the one thing, learning and unlearning. I think a superpower that I think has been underestimated lately because of just social media and scrolling and all is reading. I think reading is our big superpower, and anybody that can sit down and read books and get the information from books has such an advantage in this world, because that's really where you can learn, and where you can, Mad Dog Mattis, the general, but a very educated, warrior, really cool guy. He said, if you haven't read hundreds of books, you are functionally illiterate, and your personal experience won't be enough to sustain you, to be successful. And I think that's true. You have to continually be feeding yourself new ideas and different people's perspectives and getting in other people's minds and getting out of your own head.
Challenging your own beliefs and assumptions. That's
challenging your
grow.
Own beliefs and assumptions. Absolutely. Thinking of for traders too, and for investing, Morgan Housel's new book that just came out last year takes a really interesting approach to investing. It's like, we're always looking for the latest, the next big thing, the latest thing, what's changing. Is AI going to disrupt everything? What are the disruptive forces going to be? And he takes the opposite approach, which is like sort of a Charlie Munger's way of thinking, always think invert things or something, instead of think about what's changing, think about what's staying the same. And so his whole book is these premises about what's been consistent over time. And that's something that you can invest in because it's probably going to stable and make money. Like candy bars or whatever, kind of things. They're like, oh, people always buy those. And they've been doing that for 70 years. And
what did Warren Buffett say about the dot-com bubble when that was going on? He said something like, I don't know about all these, internet companies, but I do know that everyone wakes up in the morning and shaves with a razor. And that's
there
when
you
he
go.
Bought Gillette.
Exactly.
Right. And,
during the Depression, one of the things that didn't, in the Great Depression was makeup. Revlon.
Really?
Did very stable and good. Yeah, because it was a simple, like lipstick or something was one of these things that was cheap. Women could buy it and feel good about themselves. When you couldn't have a lot of other things, how do you, people fall back on some, small.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. There's little small things that you can get that give your outsized, happiness for the purchase, right? So identifying what those are, those are going to probably be a lot more resilient in those down markets.
Right. In times of scarcity, those things will sustain. Same thing with Churchill was, they were considering during World War II in London, they needed to start, in England, they needed to start doing lots of rationing, rationing gas, rationing butter.
Just watched the thing on that.
Did you? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The Tasting History with Max Miller on YouTube. We've been watching a lot of his content. He's done some things on, he'll make the meals that they eat during those periods. Like he did one for Stalingrad, and it was some
I don't know what they were eating there. Yeah,
that one was not a good one.
Shoe leather or something. Yeah, they were. That was one of the toughest times ever.
No, that was actually really fascinating, because guess where they went to get their recipes during World War II when they're in the middle of being invaded by the Germans? They went to the people in the gulags. They went and grabbed recipes from them
survived.
Because they had nothing to work with, and so yeah.
How are they scratching out an existence?
Right.
That's really interesting. So they created this laboratory for their own survival.
Right. Oh, on accident.
Wow. On yeah. accident. Yeah. That's really remarkable. Yeah. And they were going to, one of the things they were going to ration was tea, mm-hmm. you know, because they just couldn't get that much tea. And then they decided against it because they felt that, the people really needed to sustain themselves through this dark time, some little pleasures that they could, you know, hang on yeah. to and do. So they didn't ration tea, and it was probably a good idea. If, you know, you can never think of the counter fact. Well, what if they did, would it have been okay? But because they didn't, it gave people a, you know, a way to stiff upper lip and grin and bear it, you know, carry on.
You
know?
Right. You got to have some of those niceties, right?
And I think a lot of times those things, even when you get wealthy, right? Instead of like, well, how do you stay wealthy? You know, right? Yeah. As a, if you make those wins, do you go out and buy the Lambo and, you know,
right.
get a giant house with a big mortgage? Or do you fall back on some of, you know, like reading a book or something? You know, that's 20 hours for like 10 bucks, you know?
I think if you look at food, it's kind of fascinating to see how foods change over time. Like you look at something like lobster and seafood, those used to be like very, very poor dishes. Nobody wanted to have that. But I think what happens is you get people who grew up poor in America eating those foods, and then they get successful and older, and then they start to reminisce and want those comfort foods from their childhood again. And then they become popular with the wealthy.
That's a very good insight. Yeah, I could see like lobster would be like, oh, it's like a cockroach from the sea or something.
Right. No, it's basically that. A lice. Yeah.
Right.
Right. But now it's a delicacy.
And now it's a delicacy. That's really interesting. Right. It's a very good insight. Yeah,
I think that happens a lot.
Yeah, I think you're right. As people change, and especially, I think that's maybe a good sign too of upward mobility that that people can, you know, move
right.
up and become rich, and they still, oh, this is something I remember. It's a comfort food or a comfort kind of setting in this new disorienting world of, you know, sitting in my mansion,
right.
sipping cognac.
Yeah, it's something, some connection to your past and who you are almost, right?
Yeah, right.
So now that we've mentioned upward mobility, I think we can talk about your other project you got going on. I see that you are running your own kind of alternative to college, it kind of looks like, with your MBA ASAP.
Yeah, thanks, Kyle. Yeah, it's basically that came out of my, my entrepreneurial things. You know, I started a bunch of companies. I ended up taking two of them public. I was a public company, CFO and CEO.
Can you say which ones they are?
Yeah, but they're no longer public. One I took private and the other one got delisted and went away. But this is back in around 2000, early 2000s. And one was called Biomoda.
Oh, that is a tough time.
Yeah, trading symbol BMOD, it's gone. And the other one is Advanced Optics Electronics. Its trading symbol is ADOT. But for 15 years, I was a CFO and CEO of public companies and, you know, did all of the reporting, the 10-Ks and raising money that way. Reason I went
Sounds public, like they shouldn't have let you go.
Yeah, I went public with those companies was that it was a good way to raise money back then for
yeah.
startups. These were relatively startup companies and to provide liquidity, right? Like I'm a startup investor now. And when I go and invest in a company, you know, I get on their cap table and, but I give them the money and I do not see that money back if I'm lucky for like 5, maybe 7 years, maybe 3
oh, wow.
years if you're lucky, if they have an exit, right? And so your money's tied up. Mm-hmm. And with a public company, you know, you can go and invest in, you know, Microsoft right now. And then if in 6 months you realize, gee, I need that money for something else, you can just trade out of it and you get your money back. And so you have that liquidity, you know, your funds
yeah.
are liquid. And so that's why I took those companies public was to provide my investors with liquidity. So and also the stock market is essentially a pricing mechanism. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
it's a price discovery mechanism because it's an auction. You know, there's the bid
yeah.
and ask, and people constantly it's going up and down, and people are saying I'll buy it for this much and I'll sell it for this much, and we come to an agreement, and that's the price. And that price discovery. With a startup company, you really can't do that. You're just guessing and saying, my company, you know, has a $50 billion valuation. And so I'll sell, you know, 10% of it for $10 billion. That you're pulling that number basically out of thin air. You know, you
right,
don't have any,
right.
it's not tested in a community of investors that are saying, this is what I think it's worth. So for those reasons, I took those companies public and it was kind of a good idea, but then, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley and these other rules came in that made the reporting requirements pretty, you know, oppressive. And so it ended, and then also pre-revenue companies and small revenue companies that had lots of startup potential weren't really valued by the public markets that well. So there was downsides too.
I think you get a lot of the short people coming in there trying to obliterate.
I got killed by short positions, and I did a couple of financings that were convertible debentures, mm-hmm. where it could be converted at a discount into tradable stock out of a loan, right?
Okay.
And then those guys, I mean, it was the Wild West. You know, these guys would take short positions to drive down the stock so they'd get more stock at a lower price, and then they sell that, and it would
start a death spiral.
My cap tables just went terrible. Yeah, so I learned a lot there. So I was doing that kind of stuff and started a dozen or more companies and took those two public and got all my, you know, sort of bruises and experiences that way, you know, earn while you learn or learn while you earn kind of stuff. And then I started teaching in universities at night. You know, I thought, you know, that my sister was doing it. I thought that was so cool. So I started to, and I really liked that. But
see, that's the way I think teaching should be. I think teaching should be after you've gone and gotten some life experiences, then you go back. I never respected a teacher that was 20 years old coming in trying to teach me, you know?
Right. Like, you know, it's like, you know, like von Clausewitz, the famous Prussian general said, you know, no battle plan survives the first contact with the enemy. You got to go out and test your ideas in the real world. And that's why another thing about colleges and universities is most of the teachers are, I was what they called a pracademic. I don't have a PhD. I have my MBA, but not my PhD. All of the teachers were PhDs. You know, you go to university, that's a requirement. And when you have your PhD, you've spent your time in academia, but you haven't been out in the real world, you know, taking your, you know, losses and hits with, you know, reality like that. And also when you get your PhD, they don't study pedagogy. They don't study how to teach. They study their particular research niche, and they write their dissertation, and then they have that dissertation, and this is what they know. And now they're going to go and teach people, you know, and so they've sort of, you know, you talk about ivory tower or whatever, you know, they're teaching entrepreneurship or marketing or leadership when they haven't led anybody but themselves, you know, kind of thing. And so they didn't have the practical kind of chops that I thought, you know, and the textbooks were like this thick, you know, 800 pages on accounting, you know, or 800 pages on finance. And I'm like, I'm a public company CFO, and I may use, you know, 20 pages of that book if I boil it down, right? These are the fundamentals, the things that you do every day that are really important. And this other stuff might be academically or intellectually interesting, but not really practically usable every day kind of thing. So then I started to write my own stuff, and you know, I started publishing that, and then I started recording my lectures just on my phone, you know, on a little tripod on a desk with, you know, a little clip-on mic, and go up to the whiteboard, and then I'd cut that into a video, and then I started uploading videos to, there's platforms like Udemy and Skillshare. And Udemy became a very good one for me. They have a lot of courses. They have a whole ecosystem of students that are in those courses. They have a thing called Udemy Business that companies purchase access to for their employees, and then their Udemy curates all these different courses, and then their students can take those courses for free. So they're upskilling and reskilling, you know, onboarding their workforce, you know, is the idea, so that they have more skills. And as they get more badges or whatever for the company, you know, that allows them for promotions and things. And so, and then Udemy pays me and the other content providers by how many minutes are viewed or consumed of our content each month. And so the money that the revenue they get from the companies, they distribute a bunch of it out to the people, depending on how much the metric was of how much they watch, which is a nice way. So it was easy for me to start my online business that way and test it. And then also in the classroom was like my laboratory for what were, you know, I could see when the light bulbs went off with students and when they just glazed over because I was, you know, going on about something.
It's such a good feeling, isn't it, when you see that light bulb or when they see that the thing click in somebody's head? That's such a powerful feeling.
That to me, that's angel's pet. You're right, Kyle. Yeah. That's what I go for. You know, that's the satisfying moment of I've given somebody something that they didn't know before, and that might be an inflection point in their life too. Who knows where, but something may be better. And so that's why I do it. You know, that's why I love to do it. And the same thing with managing people. I you know, in a company, I always really got the best satisfaction by people that would come in Yeah, you hire people and maybe they're at a lower level and they're unsure of themselves and they don't, and you give them some, responsibilities, and then they're afraid, what if I screw up? And you know, don't worry. If you screw up, tell me, we'll figure it out. And after 6 months, after a year, you see that they start to get confidence. They've been through it a few times. They know if they make a mistake, we can course correct quickly. And, you know, it's not, you know, blame or anything like that.
Once they know that you got their back, that's all you really have to do. You got to let them screw up one time and you got to help protect them from the fallout of it. You do that one time and then...
Right. They trust you. They get into this learning mode where it's like, how do you learn other than what we call failure, right? Failure isn't really a failure. That's another, you know, learning how to learn. That's how we learn. If you think of it as experiments, right? This is an experiment. If it goes wrong, you tested your hypothesis. It didn't work. Let's try something else.
The best manager I ever had, he used to tell me, is if I have to tell you how to do your job, then one of us is redundant.
Redundant.
And that's such a great lesson, I think, to learn early in my career, that I don't need to micromanage. I don't need to be the smartest person in the room. I don't need to. All I have to do is I have to protect my guys from the people above me, and I have to give them the tools to do their job.
Right.
What I would do is I get a new guy and I give him a project and I say, okay, this is what I want done. I give him the goal of the project and I just tell him what the resources he has. It's up to him to figure it out. If he needs help, he can come to me and I'll help him, but I'm not going to tell him how to do it because I want him to take ownership of that. You let the guy start taking ownership of their projects and suddenly they start caring and they start really learning and doing amazing things. They'll surprise you. But you got to give them that ownership. It has to matter to them.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you, Kyle. And, you know, I remember, I think it was Patton even said that, you know, like, here's the objective. Here's the resources you have. You know,
do it.
There's probably 20 ways to do it or whatever, you know, but yeah, go do it. It's up to you.
Come to me if you need help. I'm always interested because I want to see what approaches they take. I might learn something. They might come at it a completely different way.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying, this is the way you do it. Yeah, right. Exactly. They can come with it. And it's like, wow, I didn't even think of that. And it was a shortcut and it really worked.
Right.
Yeah. And if they don't do it, then we try something else. And like you say, if they know they have, I remember Reid Hoffman, the guy who made LinkedIn, he was one of the PayPal mafia guys, you know, that sold PayPal to eBay. Really smart guy. And he said, you know, that I will accept, you know, 20% footfalls. And footfalls, I was like, what's footfalls? It's a term from tennis where if you step on the line, you know, you're out of bounds and that's a footfall. So he said, you know, I accept 20% mistakes or something like that. And, and you know, it's like, if you're not making mistakes, right, you're not trying, right. You're not pushing yourself. You're too comfortable. Like Mario Andretti said, if you're, you know, the race car driver, you know, if you're totally in control, you're not going fast enough.
Well, they can have that one.
Yeah, right. that's sort of like the Stephen Wright one about 60 in the 30. But so then we get back to your question about the MBA SAP. So that's why I started realizing, you know, these teachers don't really have real world experience. The textbooks and stuff are making the students kind of clueless because it's so much information. They don't know what's really important or what's not.
Yeah.
And so I started to say, here's the fundamentals, you know, like blocking and tackling in football, you know, the fundamentals, and then you can build, you have a context, you can build this other stuff. And so I started putting that out. And like you said, that I saw where the light bulbs would go off and would double down on that kind of approach. And then I just started to make this thing called MBA ASAP, like a Master of Business Administration. And ASAP as soon as possible. It's funny, there's some people, you know, because it's a global company now, and because thanks to the internet. So I have students in over 165 countries. I mean, just all over the world. Wow. It's really remarkable. And a lot of them don't, you know, they all speak English because my stuff has been in English so far, but I'm using an AI engine now to do it in 120 languages.
Isn't that crazy?
It's crazy. But some of them said, what does ASAP mean? And I realized, that's like an American colloquialism, as soon as possible. So now I always say, you know, it's as soon as possible is what that means. You know, I tried to go with an acronym, you know, to make it, you know, branding for MBA, ASAP, make it cute.
But I
realize not everybody knows what that means.
Right. But it's funny the things that pop up when you don't think about. I wouldn't have thought, who doesn't know what ASAP means? I guess.
Right. Yeah.
90% of the rest of the world, too.
Yeah. And I have students in like the Maldives and Mauritius and all throughout Africa and Southeast Asia and all over the place. And it's so satisfying to talk. And all of these people, you know, all of my students, they're aspirational, you know, they want to learn more. They want to get ahead in life. They want to have these tools. And I think business tools are great for anyone, you know, like whether you're a baker or an artist or a writer or whatever, you know, a musician. If you know business, that's a skill stacking bunch of skill sets that'll work with anything. Like think of how many musicians we've heard about where their accountant or their manager ripped them off, you know, and, you know, because they didn't know accounting. Now you look at the Rolling Stones and you wonder why, wow, they've been successful for 70 years or whatever, 50 years. Mick Jagger went to the London School of Economics.
Okay. All right. That makes sense.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, this guy, they're not, you know, they're pros and they covered those bases and they're also incredibly talented and, you know, and driven musicians. And I always think, you know, Keith Richards never missed a gig. It's like, wow, you know, you think of him as like, oh, he's the icon of Degenerate or something like that.
Yeah, I know.
The guy never missed a gig, you know?
Dennis Leary used to say, if you lock up Mick Jagger and Keith Richards and all them in a room full of cocaine, they just come out and do a double album.
Yeah, right? I just, animals of productivity. Right. Yeah, just amazing, amazing guys, you know?
So you mentioned music a couple times, and I think before we were recording, you mentioned that you got your start in the music industry. And I saw one of your books is actually about Miles Davis. So you've written books on music even, too.
I have. I love music. I've actually written two books on Miles Davis because I've been working on a third, but I haven't published it because the guy hit was just through all of those incredible jazz, you know, periods and styles from the late 40s through the 80s even, but, you know, through the mid-60s, I say, were that golden age of jazz, you know, from like, say, right after World War II, when they went to small combos to the mid-60s, where rock sort of really took over. That was like the golden age of jazz.
I think the Mississippi Delta Blues is the golden age of music, personally, but I'm just a huge Muddy Waters fan.
I'm with it. Well, you know, me and my best friend from back when we were 4 and 5 years old, I just found out about it, and I said to him, let's do it. So we're going to do it this spring, is the Mississippi Blues Trail.
Nice. Have you heard about that? No, I haven't. I used to live in Mississippi, too, for a couple of years.
They've made this Delta Trail down sort of right along the river there.
Yeah.
And I thought the Delta, I've always loved Mississippi John Hurt, you know, Mississippi Fred McDowell, Blind Lemon Jefferson, all those, you know, really Howlin' rootsy
Wolf.
Guys.
Yeah.
Howlin' Wolf, you know, and Muddy Waters and, you know, Robert Johnson, you know, all those kind of things. And so now they've made this trail, you know, for tourists basically, but to sort of memorialize this with like 220 markers along the Mississippi Delta Trail through Clarksdale and all these towns, you know, the home of all these guys and where they played and, you know, the crossroads where Robert Johnson supposedly made the deal with the devil to become the great guitar player, all those kind of things. And so you start in Memphis, Tennessee, and then you drive down. And you can visit there's all these museums, and there's Morgan Freeman owns a blues club in one of these funky old towns, and it's supposed to be the, you know, the best place to go see blues.
Beale Street in Memphis is one of the most amazing places I've been.
I'm looking forward to. So we're going to go down there and visit all that stuff in the spring, maybe in May.
And,
what I didn't realize, though, as I was looking at, I always thought the Mississippi Delta and Delta Blues, I thought that was the delta of the river way, way down in Louisiana.
Like, yeah.
It's actually from Memphis. It's the northwestern part of Mississippi.
I lived.
And it's the floodplains there, and they call that the delta. And I didn't realize that it was so far kind of north from where I was
thinking
it was. Yeah. And that's what they call the Delta, I'm totally into that music and Chess Records, right? You know,
yeah,
that's also the Chicago Electric Blues.
Did you watch the movie they did? Was it Cadillac Records? I think was the name of the movie.
Oh no,
that's a really good flick. If you haven't seen that, it follows the life of Muddy Waters and his whole career, basically.
What a great guy, you know, and Sonny Boy Williamson and all those guys, you know. It's amazing. Back to the Rolling Stones in a weird way, but that British invasion and those guys were huge. All of those musicians, back Jimmy Page and, you know, those Led Zeppelin records, and supposedly they took some Sonny Boy Williamson tunes, Cream, you know, and those kind of blues-based bands.
Even some of those old Pink Floyd albums had some really bluesy types on tracks on them.
Absolutely, but it took those English guys looking at America and saying that those guys are our heroes, they're so cool, for us to recognize that we had this treasure trove of musicians and musical heritage and all. It's just amazing, you know? Sometimes you have to be on the outside to see it, you know?
I guess so, right?
But yeah, I'm a jazz piano player, and you know, I have a little digital audio workstation. I make music and stuff like that. I just love it. And I like writing about it. I have another book about the Great American Songbook, which is the songs of the 20s and 30s. You know, in 20s, it was the Hollywood musical, Broadway musicals. And then in the 30s, it went to movies, to the Hollywood musicals. And so all those guys like, you know, the Gershwins, George Gershwin, mm-hmm. and Ira Gershwin, and Cole Porter, and Rodgers and Hart, and all those great composers and lyricists from that time. And then basically Miles Davis was one of the big engines of it. In the 50s, those tunes got a resurgence because the jazz guys stripped them down to their harmonic, you know, fun, and made them more jazzy, and played those tunes and put them on their records and stuff. And so a lot of those Great American Songbook tunes lived through the 50s and 60s and 70s as jazz standards. And then from there went on, and you know, like Wynton Marsalis and Diana Krall and all those people now that are popular, they still play those songs, and it's perpetuated this, you know, these songs have been around for 100 years now because of the jazz tradition basically repurposed those and saw, sort of like the English guys, you know, seeing the blues guys and repurposing them with electric guitars, you know. That's right. What they did. That was their innovation, was taking these, you know, these blues tunes and blues forms and then, you know, just cranking it up to 11.
Right. Man, we talked about a lot of stuff here so far. What else should we... I mean, we didn't really talk too much about the hedge fund that you manage. How did you get involved in getting... Was that Tetris...
Tetractus, yeah, it's a weird name. I'm a little too cute with that, but
I gotta know what it's from, because I think I looked up that should be something like
Pythagorean.
Is that something related to Pythagoras?
Oh yeah, very good. Yeah? Okay. Hardly anybody ever looks it up. Yeah, but that's what it is. It's Pythagoras was, you know, an early Greek philosopher, and his whole thing was that underlying reality was a mathematical consistency. And back then it was considered mystical, you know, that there's a mathematics underpinning to reality.
Yeah, I remember he had a huge like philosophy almost, like not just his math.
Totally.
His math is what stuck around because it was what was right. But
but he had a whole mystical cult and a philosophy around it. And there was a secretive society. And one guy supposedly divulged some of the secrets, and they tossed him off the boat and he drowned. And, you know, they were really intense about you know, keeping their trade secrets, you know.
Right.
But so Pythagoras had all that. And now, you know, it seems like, wow, the mathematics, he was so perceptive without really intuitively knowing. Because now, you know, think about physics, think about technology. It's all math-based, you know, all engineering is math-based. So we've learned to harness our reality and put it to work for us through mathematics.
Maybe he was right after all.
He was right. What it seems. And so Tetractus is a symbol. It's 10 dots, 1, then 2, then 3, then 4, like a little triangle.
Yeah. Like
10
dots
bowling. In a triangle.
Yeah.
Right. Like a bowling pin. Exactly.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, the Greek word is Tetractus. So I called my hedge fund, it's a quantitative hedge fund that I do, you know, so I'm using computers and quantitative techniques to sort of parse alpha, you know, the signal out of the noise to see, try to get predictive power of where a stock price is going to go. And so that I use that symbol as the underlying, you know, all this computer and math is represented by that Tetractus. So yeah, and so it's basically it's a private fund, and my trading really came out of being on the other side, being a CFO essentially, and you know, running companies.
Do you pay more attention to like the company management and philosophies and that kind of stuff?
And the reporting, the 10-Ks, the financial statements, you know, peeling those apart, looking for different trends in those and what they're trying to hide and what they're...
Yeah, you're probably pretty good at spotting what the people are trying to hide.
Well, that's what it kind of, you know, you know, I learned the sort of the tricks from the trade from the other side. So that when I became an investor, it's like, oh, interesting. You know, this guy's doing this and this guy's doing that.
Have you written down those tricks yet in a book? That's the one I'd be interested in reading.
No, but that's what I trade on, kind of things. Basically, you know, I use computers to do that, but a lot of it too is still, I don't think the computers are as good as humans in some parts. You know, I think the complementary of the two, you know, I don't do speed, you know, trading where it's just like
high frequency,
a lot of high frequency trading with computers, but I use computers to gather a bunch of information and then I make decisions about it. Sort of that pairing of a human with a computer, I think is best. Yeah. And so I'm basically, you know, long stocks, short derivatives is my kind of, you know, overall strategy. And the great chess player, Garry Kasparov, right? When in the 1990s, IBM made a program called Deep Blue. And finally it was going to, you know, beat it. And it beat Kasparov, who was the grandmaster at the time, you know, the Magnus Carlsen of the 1990s. And instead of being disappointed and all this stuff, he started working with chess programs. And it turns out that now the best chess player isn't a human and isn't a computer, but it's a combination of the two.
Really?
And they call that, they call that a centaur.
Really?
And there's a name for that. They call it a centaur. Yeah, like, a, you know, half human, half horse kind of thing.
You're saying that a combination of the two could beat a program like Stockfish or Leela?
Yeah.
Like one of those super engines? That's crazy.
Yep. That's what they say. And because there's human intuition and if you complement it in the right ways, it's a very powerful combination. So that's kind of my, you know, my applications in investing. And
do you play chess?
Yeah.
Are you on chess.com?
I am on chess.com.
Okay. Yeah. You need to friend me because I need people to play with.
Hey, great.
I'll send
that's
you my username.
That's a great program.
I know. I love it.
Oh, super. You know, it's amazing that they, you know, talk about an innovative matching engine kind of thing. Like, you know, all over the world you can play and with people of your level. And I've gone through all of the trainings, you know, that they have.
Okay.
They're really super. That's just a great way to kind of bring the world together over this game that's been around for a long time. And, you know.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
You can just get rid of the cheaters.
That's the thing. Now, right. There's a lot of, they can go and have a chess program running and then they make their moves based on that. And for a long time, I was just playing the bots that they have.
That's what I usually do. That or friends. I like playing against people I know because I like to be able to talk about the game. And
that's what I like too. Yeah. And I think that, you know, the bots are kind of tough. Even if you play one at like 1200 or 1500, whatever, you know.
Because they make the weirdest mistakes. They don't make human mistakes.
They don't make,
it's almost like they're just designed to sometimes pick not the best move, but it happens randomly and it'll happen like in a position where there's only one good move and it'll just blunder a piece. Oh, okay.
I agree. Yeah. And so it doesn't give you, that's why I came to the same conclusion. It's not giving me good training for actually playing the game because they're randomly making their mistakes or whatever. And also, because it's a program, they're thinking, they've looked the permutations 10, 12 moves out, and they're picking, you know, the really good, the things that we can't do. So it's kind of fun, but it's not that.
If you spend a bunch of time studying openings and learning all the theory, and then you'll find like three moves in that's worthless because the people you're playing with don't know any of that theory and they're just playing whatever.
Right. I love just studying those things too, because it's really interesting that there are all these, you know, different openings and different defenses for black and how do you,
that's why my wife doesn't like playing games with me is because I'm always looking at every game like that, trying to find like, what's the strategy? What's the edge? Like even those like Makala, like where you, the little bead games where you're trying to just clear like a couple cups out. I'll be looking at like, what's the opening move for this? That like, you know, what if she does this, then I should do this. And
what's the optimal moves exactly?
Yeah.
I used to play that game at the, when I was a kid in grade school, they had that at the park in the summer, you know, they had one of those park programs. And they had that game. We'd go around playing that Makala. Yeah. And
that's a fun little game.
It is, but I'm totally with you on
that.
Know
what you mean. Like,
I like to geek out on, you know, what's optimal. Do you play Texas Hold'em at all? And
I used to be really into cards as a kid.
Up through
I was about 22, I think, is when I stopped like trying to play like seriously. But yeah, that used to be how I got my beer money when I was in high school. Like I moved out in high at my senior year, and so we'd have a poker game every Friday night, and we'd always invite a couple of people that we knew would be good for
get your beer money from. Well, yep. You know what? That's out. Supposedly during World War II, Richard Nixon, the president, was in the Navy, and on the ship they'd always have a poker game. And
he had a lot of poker games on the ship.
He made so much money while he was in World War II on the Navy ships out in the Pacific that staked his first run for political office.
I can believe that. There's some degens on those boats. Well, you get a bunch of 18-year-olds that have nothing. Like they have no bills. They don't even have a house. They're just living on the ship. Yeah, there's a ton of money just flinging around.
You gotta kill the time, between. battles and stuff like that. And
we did a good job though of not letting anyone get too out of control. We usually cut people off if they got too deep into the rotating poker games on the sub that I was on.
Yeah, we
didn't want any of that. I would cut people off. Like, I don't want you owing me more than like $200 because.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I don't want to come break your kneecaps,
Luckily, never had to do that.
No, but those games, there's all this like GTO, is it game, optimized. Game theory optimization, of Texas Hold'em. And these ways of what is the optimal moves, and then
you'd really like Flaherty,
implied pot odds and reverse pot odds and all those kind of things of thinking about the probabilities and I think it's a lot like trading too.
Lot like trading. Bankroll management is hugely.
Yeah, bankroll management, bet sizing. Yes. John Kelly and bet sizing and
Kelly criteria. Nice. Sorry.
Yeah, those kind of things. And there's also probabilities, if you have an 80% probability, well, there's still a 20% probability that you can lose, and that happens. And it playing cards helps you to gain intuition about the size of those probabilities. It's 85%, I like those odds, I'm going to win. Well, that means 15% of the time you're still going to lose.
Right.
And when you start to see that over time, you start to realize that's not a sure thing, And so you start to manage your positions a little bit differently, I think. And gaining intuition about probabilities and thinking probabilistically about life in general, and not getting caught up in resulting where, you make a decision based on what you know as the information, and we're all making decisions on partial information, incomplete information. And then at the end, if it goes wrong, you think, oh, it was a bad decision, when really you made the right decision, that just the probability wasn't on your side, the luck wasn't on your side, or the same thing. And I think a lot of people, entrepreneurs and business people and traders, if we luck out and we make something that works right, we think, I'm a genius.
Yep.
I'm a genius. Everything I touch turns to gold. And that's a very dangerous place to be too. Life is one long lesson in humility to some degree,
That is an excellent quote. I think that's actually probably a good place to end this. John, I really, really appreciated this conversation.
Oh, thanks. Me too.
Ended up going wider and wider ranging than I expected it, but I'm happy that I got to take this journey with you. I think that is probably going to do it for today's episode, though. So please join me in thanking Mr. Cousins for taking time out of his day, because he probably could have written at least two books by now. Check the links in the show notes for his list of works. And with over 60 of them, there's bound to be something that catches your eye. And you can also go to mba-asap.com to check out his online MBA courses. And of course, you can visit Banded Traders Podcast so you never miss a new episode. We'll be back soon with another exciting guest of mine for trading and life lessons. But until then, like, share, subscribe, all the things, and have a great day. This podcast is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It does not constitute financial or investment advice and should not be construed as such. The hosts, guests, and contributors of this podcast are not licensed financial advisors, brokers, or professionals. Any trading or investment decisions made based on the content of this podcast are solely at the listener's discretion and risk. Trading and investing in financial markets carry inherent risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Listeners should conduct their own research and seek advice from qualified financial professionals before making any financial decisions.
The views, opinions, and information shared in this podcast are those of the individual contributors and do not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the podcast creators or associated organizations.
Produced by China Shop Productions.